good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the story behind the story, the news behind the news, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, sponsors, backers of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And if you're out there in the listening audience, we'd love to hear from you. Our number 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY out there across America. We're back on the Internet tonight. Our web space has been down for about a week, but now we're back in the land of the living, so we hope that you're out there listening, and it's good to have you back. And we have on the line with us Dr. Mark Andrews. Mark, are you there?
I am here, Dr. Stan.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us. And Mark is a family doctor. Whereabouts do you practice?
Well, before my Y2K-induced sabbatical, I've been doing family practice in Portland, Oregon.
Okay, fine. And have you sort of given up your practice, trying to explain to people the significance of Y2K?
You know, I have. I quite honestly set out to disprove that Y2K could be anything nearly as bad as some people were saying. And in the process, I became convinced that it was, in fact, as bad as a lot of folks were saying, and realized that I could probably save a lot more lives by making people aware and encouraging them to be prepared and have some contingency plans than if I were to continue with medicine.
All right. Well, of course, you know I'm an orthopedic surgeon, and I gave up medicine some years ago because I feel that if we don't inform the people about what's going on, we're going to lose America. And, of course, I was getting to a time when I could still retire, but I still had the ability to communicate. And God somehow got us a radio station and got us a microphone. And actually, of course, on some of our programs, we have access to the whole world. Right. In fact, we do on this program because this is being heard on the Internet, so people all across America can hear it. Although we've been down off, our website's been down for a week, although we're up again tonight, I hope we haven't lost our listening audience out there. Incidentally, if you're out in the listening audience and listening to us on the Internet, you can just give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Let us know you're on the line. You don't have to come on the air. But anyway, Mark, how did you find out about the Y2K program, and or problem, I should say, and then, you know, what convinced you that it was really as bad as some of these people are saying?
Well, the way I found out about it was this. I had been getting some financial magazines. I had read some news reports, and they were basically saying Y2K is going to be horrible.
And now, was this Gary North?
I'd gotten some information from Gary North and some other sources. And, you know, you've heard the type of comments that are made. You know, the government's coming to a screeching halt. The airplanes are going to drop from the sky. Your VCRs won't be programmable. The electricity is all going to go off. And I sat down one day, and I was opening my mail, and I got a pamphlet from my bank, the Union Bank of California. They sent it to me because I had a business account there. And when I opened it up, it said, do you know what the year 2000 problem is? And they went ahead to explain it. They went ahead and explained that if I didn't get it fixed, I'd be out of business. They then gave you 10 steps to work through as you were addressing your own year 2000 problem, mentioned again that it was real serious and you'd be out of business if you didn't get it fixed. And then they came to the last paragraph where I was fully expecting them to give me the old, we just want you to know that as you go to sleep tonight, you can rest soundly because your money is safe with us. And instead, the last paragraph read something more like this. They said, we at the Union Bank of California, when we began looking into our year 2000 problem, found it to be bigger and uglier than we had ever imagined. And I said, oh my goodness, that was kind of strange. And so they referred us on to a few places where we could get more information. And I checked those sources out, and I went looking for proof that it couldn't be nearly as bad as I'd been hearing. And I found an article that was entitled, Year 2000, It's a Hoax. And in that article, the CIO, the Chief Information Officer of Reader's Digest magazine, was being interviewed by a computer tech magazine. And they were talking, and finally Mr. David Starr from the Reader's Digest got a little frustrated and said, listen, the whole thing's a hoax, pulled off on the part of the software and the hardware manufacturers trying to get all of us to buy a bunch of new software and hardware. He says, it's just not that big of a problem. In fact, it's not a problem at all. He said, to listen to these people talk, you'd think that the airplanes are going to fall from the sky, the elevators are going to drop to their first floor and refuse to move. the banks are all going to shut down. The ATM machines won't work. And the interviewer stopped and they said, well, Mr. Starr, don't you think some of those things could happen? And Mr. Starr replied, well, of course some of them will, but not all of them. At which point I started wondering, well, what was okay with him? Was it the banks? Was it the airplanes falling from the sky? If some of those things are going to happen, then that's pretty consequential. And so at that point I started looking for more and more evidence. And I came across quite a lot that suggested that it was, in fact, going to be a huge problem.
All right. Well, why don't you outline some of that for our listeners? Because I'm sure some of our listeners are skeptical about this. We've done other programs on it. But, you know, we of course, I'm firmly convinced that something significant, very, very significant, is going to happen from my own sources. But my listeners have already heard my sources. So why don't you tell us what your sources are, where you started to look, who you talked to, what actually convinced you enough to give up your medical practice, which is, I assume, your major source of income, unless you're independently wealthy, to go out on a crusade to wake people up.
Well, some of the most credible sources that I mention when I'm talking to folks are folks like Senator Bennett. He's in charge of the Senate Subcommittee on Banking.
Okay, and he's certainly been very concerned about this, hasn't he?
He's very vocal. He's convinced, well, let me say this, he's repeatedly mentioned the prospects of a huge wave of bank withdrawals, basically bank runs. He's talked to the Federal Reserve about this a few times. He recently quoted Greenspan as saying that they would basically have lots of cash on hand at the branches. Senator Bennett then announced a year and a half earlier that, well, that was fine, but he was going to have lots of cash in his pockets to see himself through the crisis, which is tantamount to basically announcing your own private bank run. He said that he is convinced that the banking industry will have significant problems. He has said, in fact, I could probably get you an exact quote here in a second, but basically he has said, in fact, that we will have problems in the banking industry, that the banking industry must recognize that it will not fix all the Y2K problems, and that it must implement contingency planning and enter into a triage mentality so that we can keep the financial systems alive barely at all costs until the problem is ultimately fixed after the year 2000. This is the guy in charge of overseeing the banks in our country. He went on to say that and this is a quote, he says, I believe this will set off a worldwide recession. And when I started hearing things like that, when I saw Congressman Horn's subcommittee release, where they took a look at different government agencies, they looked at when they started the projects, looked at what they had to do to complete the projects, took a look at how far they'd gone, and then estimated when they'd be done. Their completion dates ranged between mid-2000 and 2019, with their expected completion for the U.S. military in 2012.
Well, now, how could we possibly survive if our military is not intact? I mean, after all, you're talking about many of our combat-ready computer technology. And, of course, our military probably is more dependent upon computers than any other military in the nation, any other military in the world. So, you know, suddenly our computers go off in the military. Why, then what happens to our military ability to respond in case of an emergency?
The folks I've talked to in the military suggest that we would be absolutely dead in the water.
Well, so what are they doing about it?
Well, the Department of Defense has said a few different things, and this is one lesson that I've learned about Y2K. You have to pay close attention to whom the folks are speaking when they're speaking. When the Department of Defense is talking to the public, they have announced repeatedly that everything's fine and that they will be done on time. When, however, they're speaking to Congress or the Government Accounting Office, they have to admit that, in fact, they won't be ready. Congressman Horn thinks they won't be ready until best-case scenario 2012, military has at least admitted that they won't be completely ready till 2005. And it's probably more initially significant for the folks who live in Taiwan that don't really want to be Chinese, for the folks who live in South Korea that don't really want to be North Koreans, that have been relying on us to hold that line for them.
Well, now, what will happen as far as our jets are concerned? And because our jets are so highly computerized, does anybody have any idea? Has anybody actually checked the computer chips in the various electronic components of our jet aircraft to see how they're going to work?
I would like to think that they've checked, but the military has not released that information. But what we do know about airliners is probably somewhat applicable. KLM has announced that they found 160 non-compliant systems on board their airplanes. Boeing is not yet done with their assessment phase. That's the first 1% of a Y2K project. So we know at the very least that even the lower tech airliners have significant Y2K issues. And everybody I've talked to in the military expects that the obviously our fighting jets have a much, much greater issue.
Now, what about our satellites? Because our satellites would certainly be highly computerized. And that's how, you know, we have our spy in the sky watching everything.
Right. And that's where we get into the embedded chip problem. A lot of folks think of Y2K as being a software problem. And in a sense, it initially was. But embedded chips are obviously chips where someone took a little software program that they'd written and burned it into the chip. Now, those chips are now up in the satellites, and they cannot be reprogrammed. They would have to be actually replaced by hand. And so whenever folks talk about, well, isn't there some sort of a way to fix Y2K, above and beyond the fact that we don't have enough people on the globe to get it all fixed in time, we have to come to terms with the fact that the experts are now saying that the embedded chips are probably 80% of the Y2K problem, and we're probably spending less than 3% of the time and effort and money on them. Now, as you mentioned, a lot of those chips are in satellites, and we can't get them changed in time. And there's significant concern that those satellites will not function properly after the year 2000. And you may know, too, that, of course, we're supposed to be due for a large meteor shower this year, and NASA is expecting quite a few of those satellites to be damaged in that as well. So the satellites are going to be a real interesting issue here in the next year and a half.
Well, I wonder what that's going to do as far as our ability to, you know, communicate television, radio, things of that sort. Because that, of course, is so intimately involved with this whole satellite situation. Now, what about the electric grids across America? Because, you know, it used to be, for instance, that PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, at least in California, provided electricity for Northern California. They were an independent company. And then, of course, due to government regulations, they began to interlock the grids from PG&E to Southern California. So if Southern California had a drain, why the electricity would come from Northern California. And then suddenly we find our electric grids all across America are interlocked, and almost so that they can't pull apart. Apparently they have some sort of a controller who controls these grids. What have you learned about the electric grids across America?
The national power grid is a very fragile thing. The independent experts that are now looking at the power grid with regard to Y2K have said that they expect it to go down. They expect it all to go down for the most part. The Federal Reserve Governor, Edward Kelly, speaking to the Bankers Association, painted a scenario where the national power grid went down. The folks that live in the Northern Hemisphere have no electricity, no way to heat their homes. That, of course, means, too, that hospitals are down. It means that water is not pumping through your home because that water is pumped by electricity. It means the sewage isn't pumped away from your home. And it means, quite honestly, that if that power goes out, once a few days are passed and the electric company's backup generators, the water company's backup generators are out of fuel, that a lot of people would be at risk of dying. Now, the experts that are looking at these systems, especially some of the ones out of Britain, and I mention that because Britain and Australia have been much more open and honest in their reporting of the Y2K problem than has the U.S. press. So a lot of what we know is coming out of Britain and Australia. But the studies that they've done show that these plants, when they go down in such a way that they often take the grid with them, that machinery is irreparably damaged. We know that at this point in time, only 45% of the utilities are doing anything about Y2K, according to a recent survey. 37% had admitted that they were behind schedule, which quite honestly means it's probably significantly more work. And at this point, as best we can tell, 0% of the utilities have done anything significant with their embedded chips. We know that every time a utility is tested, to the best of my knowledge, they have gone down. And they often go down in ways that would, as I said, irreparably damage equipment. And we don't know of a single utility that's compliant yet. That's just in the U.S. Now, the rest of the world is even further behind. And that has some really profound implications for us and the global economy we live in.
All right. Now, what about China? Though China certainly isn't dependent upon, you know, computers the way the United States is.
No, China, I think, will be the superpower of the world in a year and a half. There are parts of the world where the folks have never gotten used to electricity being on all that consistently. And China is one of those places, especially out in the hinterlands. The big cities in China obviously will have problems. But China has traditionally not been nearly as computerized as we are. Their military is just barely post-World War II military. China, I think, will weather this better than most countries.
All right. Now, what do you think is going to happen then as far as banking is concerned? Do you really think that there's going to be difficulty as far as our banks functioning?
I'm afraid there are going to be huge difficulties. I base that again on Senator Bennett's comments, on the comments of the Comptroller of the Currency, on the surveys that we've been able to look at with regard to how the banks are doing, and even more importantly, how the Federal Reserve is doing. At this point in time, there is no bank of any significant size that is Y2K compliant. One of the first banks to begin working on the problem was Bank Boston. They started back in 1993-94. They worked on it for a good number of years, and then they were, quote, done, which means that they're ready to start testing. You have to understand that done doesn't mean you're really done. It means you're ready to start testing. The experts all agree that you need to spend as much time testing, if not more, than you spent trying to fix the problem in the beginning. In fact, with banks, it's closer to 80% of the entire project time needs to be spent in testing. So Bank Boston got into that testing phase about a year ago, and they've announced that it's an incredible project, that the deeper they look, the worse it gets. They're still testing and expect to be testing for another year and a half. They hope to come in right under the wire. That says a lot for some of the larger banks like B of A, who just started last year in terms of significant code remediation. But even if your bank got compliant, that doesn't matter at all unless the telephone systems are compliant and unless the Federal Reserve is compliant and unless the wire transfer systems that move the money electronically are compliant. And the Federal Reserve has 90 million lines of code. It is twice as date sensitive as is the average. And they, to the best of our knowledge, are still back in the assessment phase. There is nobody in the world that I know of with over 30 million lines of code that has ever finished a project. And that doesn't say a lot for our ability and our hopes that the Fed might get compliant.
But certainly in Great Britain, Tony Blair has authorized some $160 million, hired 20,000 programmers. England, suddenly about a month ago, already went just full force to try to get something done. It would appear that the czar that Bill Clinton has appointed seems to spend most of his time on photo ops and talking to his small staff and rather exclusive groups of dignitaries in Washington, D.C., really just saying things are really terrible and we've just got to let people know about it, but nothing seems to be really happening in our government. In other words, instead of having a massive all-out Manhattan-style project to address the issue, it's almost as if somebody really doesn't really want to address the issue.
It does look that way, doesn't it?
And
let me tell you, I'm going to read you something that our brand-new Y2K czar said.
How do you pronounce his name?
You know, I've called him John Koskinen.
Okay, I have a hard time with that one. Okay, John Koskinen. We'll call him John Koskinen.
Okay. He was over in Britain recently, and he was chatting with Tony Blair. And this is what he said. He announced that our country, our military defenses, including its nuclear arsenal, could all cease to function. And then he goes on to say, unless a bunch of action is taken. Now, you have to know that just recently, the top five guys at the Pentagon in charge of Y2K all resigned. So at this point, people are observing that no one is left at the Pentagon running Y2K. He went over there and he announced to the world that our military and our nuclear defenses could all cease to function. He then went on to say that he doesn't want to cause undue alarm, but nor can he afford to rule out doomsday scenarios, such as global insecurity, that means war, or the collapse of financial markets. Now, that should have taken up the first 29 minutes of the evening news that next night. That should have been reported all over the U.S.
Where was that reported?
That was in the London Times.
London Times, okay. And of course, did the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal pick that up?
Not that I've seen.
Do you have that clipping? Or?
You say, do I?
Yes.
Yeah, I was just reading from it.
Okay, well, I hope maybe I can get you, talk you into faxing that to me, because I would love to have it. Okay, because, you know, this is the sort of thing that needs to be said. I have a number of quotations that he's made in Washington, D.C. In fact, some he made the end of last week that I got just this last weekend from the Center for Policy Analysis. Do you know Frank Gaffney's group back there?
No, not that.
William Casey Institute, and they've been putting out a fair amount on this. And they quoted John as saying pretty much exactly the same things, but then criticizing some Republican congressmen for having said it, because he say, now, this is no time to play partisan politics. What we really need to do is get down and address the issue. But, of course, all he's doing is talking. Now, what about President Clinton and what about Al Gore? Aren't they somehow really in charge of trying to get something done?
They're supposed to be. And Clinton obviously has been pressured for quite a while to get something done. He finally appointed the Y2K czar, but as you mentioned, it hasn't accomplished a whole lot. Let me give you a little quote here from Gore.
All right.
This is from the Christian Science Monitor on March 4th. It reads like this. Gathered at the long table in the cabinet room of the West Wing, the president's cabinet recently listened to Vice President Al Gore, the techno-nerd, as some at the gathering have described him, drone on about a technical glitch that will hit most computers in the year 2000. Americans, he said, will hold the White House accountable. Looking around the table, Mr. Gore warned that, and you got to hear this, that, quote, one of you will likely get singled out as personally responsible for the administration's failure to get on top of this problem.
I heard she said something like the poster boy, that phrase.
Yeah.
You'll be the poster boy for this catastrophe
yeah.
when it hits.
And so here we are in early 98. Al Gore is basically announcing to the world that we're not on top of the problem, that one of the folks in the president's cabinet will be held responsible. And again, our media doesn't really pick up on that and sound the alarm, because what's at risk here is of profound importance. It's our ability to get water, our ability to produce food, our ability to stay alive, and to keep millions and millions of Americans from quite literally dying. And yet, play politics, and they have not addressed this as if it were the largest battle that mankind has ever faced. When in fact, it would appear that it is.
All right. Now, what other things do you think that we may very well face? Are you concerned about the maintenance of our health care delivery system? How will this impact on hospitals?
Oh, it's going to be profound. There's a group at RX2000 that's been trying to compile a database of hospital systems, and some estimates so far have been that up to half of the medical devices we use are noncompliant. Medical devices we never would have thought were at risk. For instance, a cardioverter. For the audience, it's a little thing that you shock people with, you yell clear, you shock them, bring them back to life. They found that a lot of cardioverters have a program built into them so that it monitors how often it's been maintained. And if it realizes that the maintenance has not taken place when it should, it'll shut itself down. And we found that quite a few of those cardioverters, when they roll over to 00, will assume that it's been almost 100 years since they were maintained and thus cease to function.
They have to run them ahead to see what happens?
Pardon?
Have they actually run them ahead to see what happens?
Yeah, and Britain was one of the first folks to call our attention to that, because they started putting blue tags on everything in the hospitals that weren't passing muster.
Well, now, could they go ahead then and just turn the clock back so it would give us an extra 10 years?
Well, not in a system like that. It's a standalone system with its own clock that you can't really, get in and change. What you have to do is you have to have maintained it at a point in time when it can, you know, that it considers to have been recent enough. And so what they would have to do is then do the maintenance right after the rollover. Those same problems occur in anesthesia machines, life support systems, MRIs, CAT scanners. But all that's small potatoes if, in fact, there is no electricity, because obviously that's the showstopper for us. Infrastructure is a huge, huge problem. The water treatment plants, the sewage plants, recently one of the sewage plants here in the U.S. tested. They set their clocks ahead, and we're immediately dumping raw sewage into the rivers. Petroleum is at risk. The petroleum companies have all stated that they have significant challenges. There are 10,000 embedded chips on each of the North Sea oil rigs, all below sea level. They have to be checked manually. The processing plants are at risk, and our ability to produce diesel fuel for the trucks to move our food means our ability to produce gasoline, propane, those sorts of things. But most importantly, I think, is the food supply, because most folks don't realize that a lot of the seeds are produced in Central and South America. The farmers of the world have predominantly switched to hybrid seed for very good reasons that I probably shouldn't go into. But those seeds in Central and South America there will be thousands of reasons why they're not going to make it to the farmers of the world in the spring of 2000.
Now, you're saying because of the transportation system breaking down, because the trains won't be working efficiently, UPS won't be working efficiently because it's computer-dependent, by trucking it won't be working efficiently, all these things?
Yeah, it starts while the plant's in the field, and the first thing they have to do is water it, okay? And they turn on the irrigation pumps, and there's no electricity, so they do nothing, and the plants die. But say they get enough rain, and so the plants grow to adulthood, then they have to harvest the crop. And so they get under tractors which don't have any diesel fuel, so they can't harvest it. Let's say they get enough workers out there by hand and they harvest it by hand, and then they take it over to the processing plant where everything's shut down because there's no electricity. So then they process it by hand if they can do that, and they have to find a way to package it, which would be difficult to do since distribution is all down and there's no way to get packaging materials. Well, let's say they load it all into a truck by hand, and they turn on the key, and maybe the truck is one of the newer models that has embedded chips that very well may be non-compliant. The truck goes nowhere. But let's say they've got an old truck, and so they start up the road, and they go about 10 miles, and then they run out of fuel, and they realize there's no more diesel fuel to be found because the processing plants are now non-compliant. Having said that, they, you know, before they even went on the road, they're going to have to try to make a call up north and arrange for the shipment. And so they placed the telephone call, but you know what? The telecom industry internationally has not been tested, will not be tested, and is now presently non-compliant. The British telecom minister has announced publicly a few times that he expects international telecommunications to be down.
How about just domestic telephones?
Domestic telephones are here in the U.S. are doing a little bit better. Big boys like AT&T, GTE have significant problems. They have started earlier than most industries. GTE, for example, initially found that they had 500,000 non-compliant switches. They take a half a day each to repair. That means a team of 1,000 people needed to have started a while ago working on it. The problem is they have to get those new compliant switches made and delivered. And I know that, for instance, companies like U.S. West and other large ones haven't been able to start that process yet because they're still waiting for the new compliant switches to be made in routers. These folks have thousands and thousands of suppliers that they're waiting on to supply them with updated embedded processes as well as code. U.S. West has sold 33 million lines of code to a company in India, and that company then works on it in a warehouse over there and ships it back bit by bit. So there's significant work here to be done in the U.S. Those companies spend about 4 months with their lawyers discussing the wording of an agreement that would allow them to test about 5% of their systems against each other. Because at present, we're repairing these systems in different fashions. And no one knows yet whether or not one company's repair will be able to speak with another company's repair.
Well, now, the thing that impresses me is there must be tremendous product liability associated with this. The people who manufactured these chips now have given a deficient chip, which threatens the infrastructure of society. What about their product liability?
It's huge. In USA Today a few months ago, there's an article where they suggested that the litigation expenses out of this Y2K fiasco could reach $7 trillion. And their observation, it was $6 or $7 trillion. Their observation, I think, was correct when they said, and if it was that high, there would be nothing left to litigate. If it's that high, society as we know it is gone.
Well, actually, I understand that some states are even suggesting passing laws to limit litigation liability.
Absolutely. California tried to do that just a few weeks ago and failed. It was a little bit too broad, some people thought. But if we were going about business as normal, there would be huge litigation expenses because, you know, half the personal computers produced last year and sold last year were non-compliant. And a company has to, a customer has the expectation that a product will work for more than 3 years into the future before it melts down. So they're going to have to pass some safe harbor legislation, or corporate America would go under for no other reason than just litigation.
Well, now, my son has Windows 95, and he says he's actually run his clock forward into the year 2000, and Windows 95, and of course, he's got a very sophisticated computer, but that seems to be working pretty well.
Windows 95 works pretty well, but not perfectly. Microsoft has taken an interesting stance. They've denied problems all along the way. It's been like pulling teeth. People have had to prove one Microsoft program after another was not compliant. I'm told that recently, about a month ago, they set up a website, and I'm told that they admitted that parts of Windows 95 were not completely compliant. But Windows 95 is compliant enough for most of us. A lot of the programs that you might run under Windows 95, specifically some of your finance programs, spreadsheets, those sorts of things can very well be non-compliant.
No, I know my wife says that her spreadsheet, her accounting program is going to just die at that time, so we're planning on getting a new one, assuming, of course, we have any income after the year 2000.
Right, or electricity.
Or electricity.
Or any reason in the world to be worrying about a financial program.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment here.
Okay.
And at that point, we're going to invite you out there in the listening audience to give us a call at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LEBERTY. Dr. Mark Andrews is our guest this evening. A fascinating young man, has a lot of great information. So give us a call. Dan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time that I always have to take to remind you that we are listener-supported. And, of course, we have no great foundations or corporations behind us. In fact, Radio Liberty was my personal dream. I don't know how many of you know, but starting back about 1962, I got started in talk radio. Of course, I was one of the callers on talk radio, but I was probably the best-known conservative voice in the western United States, known as Dr. Chuckles all across the West. And for a number of years, we were constantly calling KGO. In fact, they had even given me their special number to encourage the calls because they always provoke controversy, and that's really what makes talk radio interesting. Well, anyway, of course, I always sort of dreamed in the back of my mind that someday maybe I'd be behind the microphone and I could do all the nasty things to the callers that were done to me. But, of course, that's not my nature. I'm not going to cut people off, and we'll listen to them respectfully. So if you call in, don't be frightened. I find that it's just as easy to be nice and to argue with people intelligently or discuss matters intelligently rather than simply shout at them and flip the switch, as so often would happen to me in my years of being on the other end of the line. But anyway, Radio Liberty certainly has grown, and as you know, we're now heard on 18 stations. We have the Internet. We have a shortwave on our afternoon program. We hit a large audience every weekend down in Los Angeles, and a growing audience. But it's really because those of you out there in the listening audience stand with us and help us. And if you agree with what we're doing and would like to help, we'd really appreciate it because, quite frankly, it's a tremendous financial strain on my wife and myself and our family. We just dedicate ourselves full-time to this, and we have to have help, of course, and they have to be paid, and the various bills for the various radio stations and the telephone bill. I hate to tell you what our telephone bill was last year. I wouldn't want to see you feeling badly, but it really is a tremendous expense to do all these things, and yet if we do not educate the American people as to what's going on, we are going to lose America, and then, of course, our material possessions will be relatively unimportant. If you'd like to join with us, our telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and we'll look forward to hearing from you. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening, Dr. Mark Andrews. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you agree, you disagree, you're one of the skeptics, here's a gentleman that I'd like you to talk to. He's done a lot of research, and he's convinced enough that we are facing a crisis situation and that he has given up his medical practice up in Oregon, and he's out just stumping across the land and talking on radio and talking to anybody who listens to him and saying, wake up, don't you realize there's a problem out there. What part of Oregon were you actually practicing in?
Portland.
Portland, okay. My son lives up in Silverton. Do you know where that is?
I have never been there, but I've heard of it.
It's a place where they grow a lot of Christmas trees, and it's really a beautiful little rural community, sort of a step back in time from what life is down, you know, in most, certainly in Portland and down here in California where they have one big restaurant in town. Everybody goes there, and everybody knows everybody else, and it's really a very, very nice place. He seems happy there, and I'm so glad he has found happiness. Sure. Well, anyway, now, have you just closed your medical practice? Were you in solo practice, or were you in association? What were you doing?
I had a practice of my own, and yes, I have closed that.
And so how are you managing financially, then?
Well,
or with great difficulty?
Living off savings, and folks have been very generous and helped out.
All right, fine. What happens when you begin telling people your concern about what's going to happen to our society when the clock strikes midnight on December 31st, 1999, or perhaps even earlier when some of our state or federal governments begin to shift into their next year?
Sure. What happens when you first begin telling them? I'll tell you. A lot of times, especially if you tell them a whole lot at once, they start to get that look in their eye like you're a wild-eyed, crazed lunatic. And I've seen a lot of folks who had that problem. I found that if I break the news slowly, if I refuse to tell them the whole story at one time, if I dole the information out in little bits over the next few days and then follow it with lots of email and lots of good information, that they respond better. Because I saw people running into that problem, we went ahead and produced a video, a 42-minute video and a 59-page information booklet. And that's been real helpful to folks who want to share the information with their friends and neighbors and church members and loved ones and that sort of thing. Because Americans, I find, are much more willing to sit and listen to a video and believe what's on it than they are willing to listen to their brother-in-law tell them what he believes he's found out. And so some people take it well. I find that church-going folks tend to take it a little bit more realistically than do non-church people, because, quite honestly, church believers, churchgoers, have always known that there would be bad times ahead at some point in time in the world. And they're typically folks who have always felt that their supreme happiness and their supreme faith was in God, whereas a lot of the rest of the world has come to place all of their hopes for happiness in their 401ks and their houses and their retirement plans.
Well, do you think it's something like telling somebody that they have cancer, and you see at this first this denial and then the sort of
anger
and then
depression
and then acceptance,
yeah.
Right. It's really very much like that, isn't it?
It is. You see people go through those stages of Kubler-Ross's death and dying, you can almost hear the walls being built in front of you. But every computer friend of mine who initially was, and they were all initially very skeptical, have over the last few months completely changed their mind, and each and every one of them is now storing food and thinking of safer places to live and making contingency plans in case the government does not get it all fixed for them.
Well, I fear that the government really doesn't want to get it all fixed. My personal belief is that there are some people who would just love to see this crisis come to full fruition, because out of crises comes change. And as David Rockefeller said recently, all we need is one more major crisis, and the people will accept world government.
Yes, well, we are going to have a global problem, a problem of unparalleled significance. We will require a global solution. This is a one problem that I think will bring the nation states to their knees, and they will be willing to accept whatever solution is offered them. And it will be a very vulnerable time for the world, obviously.
And, of course, I'm sure David Rockefeller and his friends, Marie Strong, Gorbachev, and the others are just waiting there in the wings, and they have a solution. And, of course, it's called World Government, Sustainable Development, Agenda 21. Call it what you will.
Right.
These things are certainly coming down the line. And, of course, have you done any thinking at all about the Kyoto Treaty, the treaty that was signed in Japan last December, where Al Gore said we were going to cut back on our electric consumption some 30 to 50% here in the next few years. And, we're talking about certainly cutting back on fossil fuel emissions. We're talking about drastic reduction in energy consumption, deindustrialization of America. And, my first impulse was, how could that ever come about? The American people would never accept that. But, of course, in a crisis situation where electricity isn't available, perhaaps it'd be much more willing to accept making personal sacrifices in order to maintain our freedom.
Right. I'm not much into conspiracy theories, but let me say this about Gore and the folks in office at the moment. If you've read Gore's book, you realize that for the sake of Mother Gaia, Mother Goddess Earth, he, as was announced at the population control meeting in Rio, thinks that we need to drastically cut back on the Earth's population. As you just mentioned, he wants to cut back drastically on some of the byproducts of technology. And having read his book and understanding the reasoning behind it, I think it's very plausible to wonder whether or not if Gore and the other folks in power actually knew how bad Y2K would be, I think it would be very reasonable to wonder if they would actually tell us, or if they would try to keep everybody as it would accomplish everything that they've announced that they want to accomplish. And I think that that's a legitimate concern for American Joe.
And I think that anybody who has not read Earth in the Balance really should, because Al Gore actually says that the automobile is not sustainable. Now, how are we ever going to get the American people to give up their automobiles? I mean, that's just like giving up motherhood and apple pie and football. But, of course, in a crisis situation, everything changes. And one only has to see what's going on in Indonesia now and the crisis that's been precipitated over there as a result of American speculators attacking the currencies of the Far East. to see what really can happen. If you're out there in the listening audience and you have a thought on what we're talking about, our number, 464-8295, or 1-888-24-LIBERTY, if you agree, you disagree, that's what talk radio is all about. So don't be bashful calling in. We'd just love to hear from you. Our guest this evening, Dr. Mark Andrews, and of course our subject, the Y2K problem, or what some people affectionately refer to as the Millennium Bug. Well, now, as we analyze what we're talking about, do you anticipate that we may very well have trouble with elevators, things like that, in our major buildings? Or what happens in major apartment buildings if there's a problem with electricity? Could we actually lose electricity in our major cities over any period of time?
Absolutely.
Well, aren't there backup generators to help things?
Not at all. That's why I'm here. I'm here to tell people, folks, it looks like the power grid is going to go down. And
you talked to people at the EPRI, the Electric Research, the Electric Power Research Institute?
I do believe I've read some things that they produce, but I've not actually talked to folks there.
Well, I actually have. And let me tell you, they don't want to talk about this subject. I've asked them to come on the air and tell us what provisions they're making, and they referred me to PG&E. And I said, but PG&E suggested I talk to you. And the amazing thing is nobody in the power industry wants to talk about this, and I can't understand why.
Well, I bet you can understand why. It's because the news is not good. In our booklet that we produced, we had folks with some websites that will give them some good information on utilities.
All right, fine. Why don't you give your telephone number out so people will know how to get your material?
Sure. Actually, we'll be overwhelmed if I do that, so let me give an address out.
All right, fine.
They can send to Mark Andrews, and it's P.O. Box 722-743. That's P.O. 722-743. Mm-hmm. San Diego, California. And the zip code is 92172. And to get the booklet and the video, they can just send $18.
All right. The $18 is the booklet and the video. And have you actually produced this video?
Yes, we've produced the video, and it has been very well received. A lot of folks have been showing it to small groups and churches and friends and family, and it's been thrilling to see what's happened. But back to your initial question, yes, I think that the utilities are in great jeopardy. What does that mean for somebody in an apartment building? Well, number one, it means you're not going to have any water coming out of your faucet. Number two, it means that it's only a matter of time until the sewage backs up. It means, of course, the elevators don't work, but that's going to be small potatoes. If the electricity is off, for many reasons, we won't see food distribution. It means if you don't have a place to go to get water in a bucket, if you don't have a place to go to dig an outhouse, if you don't have a place to go and grow some food, that apartment is going to be a very unlivable place very quickly.
Well, don't you anticipate that the government will make food available to us?
I think the government's going to have a hard time making food available to the military. Our government used to stockpile a lot of food. We do not anymore.
Why don't we? We used to have several years of food supplies.
I think it's called hubris. I think it's pride. I think we've decided that we're so self-confident and reliant that we'll never have a problem, that we fail to recognize that the more interrelated our systems are, the more vulnerable we are to a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the last growing season, we had 2 weeks' supply of food in this country in storage, and that's not going to cut it if, in fact, the farmers do not get the seed in the spring of 2000. Because at that point, if these systems fail, and I don't know of anybody who's actually looked closely at those systems globally, internationally, who's come up with any reason to expect that they won't fail. I don't know anybody who thinks that Costa Rica is further along in their Y2K conversions than we are. And if they fail, we're looking at, quite honestly, famine of unparalleled proportion.
Well, now, are you saying that Costa Rica is the source of our seeds? Are we getting
into
America?
To a great degree, Central and South America is where they grow our hybrid seed.
Well, why can't we just go back to growing regular wheat? Why do we have to use the hybrids?
Well, they like to use the hybrid because they get more bushels per acre. The sweet corn is sweeter. Red fruits are redder, and those sorts of things. Watermelons come without seeds. It's been a real boon to the farmers. They get to get more money per acre, and that's been a good thing. On the other hand, it's put us in this situation where we cannot take the seeds from those plants and save 10% of them and plant them in our garden or in our farm and expect anything viable to grow. Now, that's the way it is with the majority of the crops produced in our country. And it's a real precarious situation we're in now. It's a wonderful situation for the seed-producing companies, or has been up until now. But for the farmers, they are reliant on those seeds. And if you and your family doesn't have non-hybrid seeds available to them, then they're going to be in trouble. So I encourage everybody to right now go out and get some non-hybrid seed and grow it this summer while you still have the chance and multiply it. And next year, give a little bit of it to each of your friends and neighbors and loved ones and get them to plant it again and multiply it so that each of you will have something to do to produce food for your table come 2000.
Now, and you really think that there could actually be a food shortage here in America?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have to realize that we've got about 11-day supply of food in the pipes, so to speak, that above and beyond that, so that if the distribution system were to break down, we would be short of food very quickly. Grocery stores would be out of food in a couple days maximum. I think you're going to see bank runs and food runs in 99 as people become a little bit more concerned and afraid. My goal is to get people warned ahead enough, far enough ahead of time that they're not concerned and afraid, but that they're helping their neighbors. But
don't you think this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy? In other words,
it does.
As more and more people become aware, more and more people are going to begin stocking up on all these things, and it's going to create artificial shortages.
It will, in fact, to a certain degree, and that's a heavy burden I bear, and I wouldn't mention any of these things unless I was convinced that it was inevitable. And then, once you come to the point of believing that it is inevitable that we will see bank runs and runs on food, then you realize that the sooner you start alerting some folks to start growing their own and preparing to have some, the better off we'll all be. Now, in terms of the self-fulfilling prophecy, that's a real concern of mine in banking. And yet, when you have the Senator Bennett in charge of the Subcommittee on Banking already announcing ahead of time that he's going to launch his own little private bank run, and you've probably noticed as you read articles in computer magazines that they'll always put a happy face, smile, spin on the end of their article, and oftentimes the last paragraph will say something about, you know, probably just a little bump in the road, but just in case I'm going to go withdraw a few months' cash, you know, in December of 99. When enough people start saying that, the bank runs are going to happen regardless. I know that the bank runs have already started to happen. I guess the real question is, when will they pick up speed? I know of a banker who had a lady come in the other day and withdraw $260,000 in cash. When he called her to ask why, she said, well, Sonny, my daughter is the head programmer for the head Y2K programmer for, and then she named a bank here in America that everybody knows, and so I won't mention the name. And she called me up and said, Mom, get your money out of the bank, get it all out, get it in cash, and don't let them talk you out of it. And as those sort of things happen more frequently, it will, in fact, be a self-fulfilling prophecy. But with the seeds and with the food, we've got the chance to actually do some good right now. We need to get the seeds multiplied. And with the food, I think that what we'll see is, you know, we have four times as much poundage in this country in cattle as we do with people, I'm told. And so I think we'll find next year that maybe a lot of cattle go without grain, hopefully in an attempt to get enough spread around for the people.
Do cattle eat wheat? They eat corn, don't they?
They eat corn, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, to a great degree. And whatever corn we can spare and put aside for the people, that'll be a plus.
Okay, so. And so what you're suggesting is we just start getting all of these various things and start getting them stored away. Now, if you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number, 464-8295. You can remember that. It's 464-TAX-L, if you like to hear it that way. Or, of course, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And if you're out listening to us on the Internet across America, why, give us a call. And Dr. Mark Andrews is here. And he's, of course, gives a number of very, very plausible reasons why people really should be concerned as things begin coming down the line. Well, now, what about, you know, maintaining law and order? They're certainly going to be able to maintain law and order in the major cities, aren't they? Or are we going to have a problem if electricity goes out in our major cities?
I think we're going to have a real problem. Let me jump back real fast a second and say, I want people not to be scared when they hear this news. I want them to know that there are things that they can do, that they can do them very, very inexpensively. A year's supply of corn can cost them as little as $40 for 2,400 calories a day for a year. So everybody
What are you talking about, cornmeal or what?
If you just went out and bought just dry corn.
Dry corn.
Yeah. And you just you know, like feed corn, that type of thing. You could put away enough food for your family really inexpensively. And so in the booklet that comes with the video, we go through all that. We give you some different food packages. We tell you where to go to get it and how to do that in the most inexpensive way possible. So I want people to know, don't be at home scared to death. There are some good, easy, practical things you can do. We give you the phone numbers to call. We tell you how much to order. We tell you exactly what to do. It's something everybody can accomplish quickly. But back to your question about law and order, there's a Y2K firm here in San Diego that has produced a white paper. They're an international Y2K firm. Their comment was that in their dealings with foreign governments, and they suggested there were quite a few, that most all of them had plans underway for how to deal with civil unrest. The bottom line being they were expecting martial law. That's been something that a lot of people expect in this country. I think that as we see a lot of panic on the part of the population in 99, as we see the bank runs and food runs and that sort of thing, there will be very good reason probably for martial law. And law and order will be difficult to maintain. If the electrical utilities go out over a wide area, then that means you have no 911, you have no telephone, you have no way to call the fire engine. The police, after they've used up their stored fuel, and they keep a few days worth of fuel stored usually underground at most police stations, but once that's used up, they'll have no more. And martial law will really be the only way to keep order. And I think, you know, those of us who live in Southern California realize that it doesn't take a lot to spark off a riot. If you've seen Indonesia recently, you know that as well. And there could be some real difficult days ahead.
Well, what you're really talking about with martial law, national martial law, would be a crisis that could result in the ultimate loss in all of our liberty.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right. Well, now, are you talking to church groups? How are you getting interviews? How are you getting the opportunity to get this information out?
Well, there have been some sources on the Internet, Gary North Forum as one, and a good number of others, that have allowed us to get the word out to folks. Most of them will call and order the video. What I find then is that they're showing it to church groups, they're showing it to family members, they're sending one to each of their brothers and sisters and cousins. They in turn do that to everybody they know, and that's how the word is spreading at this point in time.
Well, are we seeing any runs on food, runs on the stored food, things of that sort?
Yeah, we sure are. And by the way, too, I just got back from a 14-city speaking tour and leave again in 2 weeks for another 14 cities, but we are seeing runs on food. Walton Feed is one of the major companies in the U.S. that packs basic grains and some of the less expensive products. Walton is now 8 months behind on their truck shipments and a couple months behind on the UPS orders. They're good people. I recommend them. Tell them I said hi if you call them. But they, as an example, are finding that there are a whole lot of people right now interested. Another source of food that I recommend to folks are the Mormon canneries.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not Mormon, but they have always taught their people that they need to store 1 or 2 years of food. And as a result, they've set up some dry pack canneries all over the country. And those dry pack canneries, we have 800 numbers in the book for all these things, but those dry pack canneries will allow you to go in and get your wheat and your rice and your beans and dried milk and all the other things that you need and package them up for yourself and do it in a really inexpensive way.
How can you, for instance, store flour? How can you store these things? Do you nitrogen pack them, carbon tetrachloride? What do you use for storage?
Well, it depends on what you're packing.
Well, what about flour?
Flour tends to last a couple of years if you pack it correctly.
Well, okay.
But if you leave it as wheat, it will last for basically ever.
Right.
And so the best thing to do is to get some of the wheat, of the flour. You can buy it from a place like Walton Feed that already in buckets. It'll be vacuum packed. They used to nitrogen pack, but now their vacuum pack is a little bit better. They have a real good book available, by the way, too, called Making the Best of Basics, and it teaches folks how to nitrogen pack. But having said that, when you go into, for instance, one of the Mormon canneries, you'll buy a 50-pound bag of flour. You'll scoop it into your little number 10 can that they provide for you. You'll throw in an oxygen-absorbing packet, put a lid on it, put it on the machine, and it'll can itself. And that'll last for 2 or 3 years nicely.
What do they do? They just delete the oxygen?
There's a little packet in there that absorbs the oxygen.
I see.
Now, what I would recommend people do instead, though, is go by their, go down there, or mail order it, whatever, get their 50-pound bag of wheat, if they're going to package it on their own. And mind you, if you keep the wheat cool and dry, it will stay good for many, many, many years, more years than you could ever need it. And so you can do something as simple as putting a garbage bag around it to keep the moths out and stacking it in your closet. Of course, the rodents can still get to it. So if you want to spend a little bit more money, get a food-grade plastic bag, a food-grade liner. You can get those from Grainger or some, maybe some friends who, you know, run a restaurant. And one of these clear or white plastic liners, you can put it inside of a 32-gallon garbage can. Buy those for $7.25. And pour about 100 pounds of wheat into each bag. Put two bags in there. And so in every 32-gallon garbage can, you could have 200 pounds of wheat or 200 pounds of white rice. Not brown rice, because that has more oil in it. It goes bad after 3 months. White rice will stay good for a long time. You could do that with beans. After 3 or 4 years, they start to get hard, probably edible for 5, and after that, you'll need to grind them. And mind you, the grinder would be something you'd want to pick up pretty early in this process. So you can store a lot of those basic grains. Corn would work well that way, too, dried corn. And really store them inexpensively, and as long as you keep them cool and dry, they'll be good for many years.
Where are these Mormon canneries you're speaking of?
They're scattered all over the U.S., there's one in San Diego, one in L.A., there's some in Portland. A lot of the major cities have them.
And how about Central California? You have any idea?
I do believe there are some small ones around Fresno and Modesto. Let me give you the phone number here, and you can call. I have to look in our booklet and find that. You can call the church in Utah and tell them, I live in such and such a place, and I'd like you to tell me where is the closest mm-hmm. dry pack cannery to me. The number you want to call there for the dry pack canneries is 1-800-453-3860.
All right, 1-800-453-3860.
Right, and then you ask for extension 4164.
Mm-hmm.
Extension 4164, ask for the dry pack cannery closest to you, and if you're fortunate, there'll be one in town. You need to go in and you pack it yourself. They want you to be involved, but I found them to be very helpful.
Well, you mean you actually pack it yourself?
Yes, you'll go in and they'll show you how to do it.
I see. And then do they buy the food and other things right there?
Yeah. The larger canneries, they're like big, huge warehouses. And some of them will actually have silos. I think that the Mormons intend to be well-fed in the future years.
And, of course, they have dried corn, all of these other things that you want to get?
Only certain canneries have corn. Most all have wheat and rice and beans and powdered milk and pudding mixes and chocolate mixes and soup mixes and all sorts of other yummy stuff.
How long will... white rice last.
You have white rice will last for many, many years.
Okay, so but the brown rice really won't last.
No, you don't want to get anything with oil in it. Along those same lines, you know, a gallon of oil won't last very long either.
How about olive oil?
Olive oil will last about 2 years.
Okay. Of course, you can always burn that in your lamps if you get into too much trouble.
There you go.
And what about things like honey?
Honey will last basically forever, and I think honey would be a great thing to have. Probably has some antibacterial qualities to it as well. The worst it'll do is get hard on you, and then you just scoop it out and melt it, and you're all set to go.
Well, now, you know, as you tell people this sort of thing, everybody, I'm sure, sort of looks at you a little askance. You know, you just talk about moving back to a very, very primitive form of life.
Yeah, you know, it leads you to think thoughts you never would have thought before, but at the same time, it's not as crazy as you might think. I tell folks this. In a very short time, the computers of the world will think it's 1900. And you need to be ready to live as if it were, which means nothing more than this. You need to do what your great-grandmother would have thought was intelligent. And for many of us, our great-grandparents, if they were to see where we live, they would think we had lost our minds. They would say, you live in a crowded little neighborhood. There's no river. There's no pond. There's no stream. There's no place to have a cow. There's no place to plant a garden. And I hear it's illegal to dig a well. You know, they would think that was just crazy. And yet we've become so reliant on systems that it may, in fact, be our downfall.
I think you may very well be.